The following episode of FOFOP is rated MA. It contains alternating hosts, a rotating roster of guests, and mild coarse language. FOFOP advises that it is not suitable for anyone under the age of 15, or anyone who came here looking for one of those highbrow NPR-type podcasts. Minors must be accompanied by a parent or guardian. This is John Deek speaking.
Hello and welcome to FOFOP. I'm Charlie Clawson and my guest today is comedian, author, life coach and participant in the greatest tragedy in podcasting, the death of Superpod, Greg Barrett. Greg, it's so good to see you. It's been, what, years? Years?
It's been years. It literally has been years.
I think last time I was...
Yeah, it's good to see you too, man.
I was in LA. We tried to catch up. You were doing a pod with your wife, a relationship podcast or something. Is that right? About three
yes,
years ago?
Yeah.
Yeah. And
yeah, we were doing a podcast together. And that didn't last.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
we decided we wanted to stay married.
Yeah. Yeah. I've tried numerous times to get Gemma. I think I've done one podcast with Gemma and it ended very badly. And that was a very casual, it wasn't even a relationship podcast. I said, hey, it'd just be fun to have you talk about your career and your life and everything like that. But no. I think she hears enough from me in my regular life. She doesn't want to have those conversations recorded.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we would get a question and then we would get on other sides a bit and then it was a lot. It's
a weird thing, isn't it, like with podcasting? I've been thinking about this a lot because, you know, with the pandemic and stuff, this has been a lot of what I've been doing is, you know, more podcasts. And, you know, Will and I obviously do a bunch together and I do another one with another friend called Dad Pod, which is like a parenting podcast. And it does eat into your conversational ability away from podcasts. You know what I mean? Like there's a bunch of things that I've wanted to talk about with people. And I'm like, I might just save that for the pod. I don't want to kind of like, you know,
right,
bleed out all the good ideas when I can't record it. You want to get value for money, right?
Totally. Totally. Yeah. I'm doing a podcast. I do a podcast it's a relationship podcast called Don't Take Bullshit from Fuckers.
Yep.
And that's the most amount of talking I do a week.
And so tell me, with that podcast, do you find that there is a common thread that, like, is there a question or a complaint that comes up more often than others?
The biggest question we get all the time is somebody will have started dating a guy. It's usually a woman who's been dating a guy, and then he just quits. He just drops out, and they want to know why. The biggest question is why? Why did he dump me? Why did he come on so strong? Why did he leave so early? You know, and it's a tough one to answer, but it's just like, because he did, you know?
And what do you think that is a symptom of? Like, do you think that is a modern phenomenon or has this been happening as long as dating's been going on?
I think it's been happening as long as dating's gone on. I think men, when they're excited, they get excited fast and then they come in and they sort of love bomb and then something happens and they realize they don't, they're unsure and then they want out.
Yeah. It's funny. Like I was asked to do not a dating podcast, but like a relationship podcast by a podcaster in Australia a few years ago. And it's been so long since I, you know, have had to think about that, like think about, you know, how I present to the opposite sex. Like when you're married, you sort of get into sort of a level of comfort and familiarity. It's like, I often say, you know, if anything were happened between Gemma and I, or I found myself single again, I just don't know that I could front up to dating again. Like the idea of having to meet someone new and get to know them and get to know their friends and get to know their family and work out what the boundaries are and stuff. It seems exhausting. Like,
oh my God, I wouldn't do it. I would really investigate the idea of becoming a monk.
Yeah. It makes sense, right?
Like, yeah, I'd really seriously get into something super spiritual because I couldn't do it.
And it's also that thing too, of when you're younger, you have the energy to present an image of yourself which is not true. You know what I mean? Like you have a bit more energy to kind of dress a certain way, listen to certain kinds of music, you know, go to certain bars or whatever because you want to be perceived a certain way. Whereas now I'm like, I have not changed my outfit in the last 4 days. It's pretty much the same thing. I'm just very comfortable in where I am. Probably probably not great for my marriage, but, you know, I think I feel comfortable where I am.
I get super comfortable too. And the idea of trying to create a persona or even have to worry about, the one thing about being married is you don't really have to worry about your partner all the time.
Yeah.
You don't have to, you know what I mean? You don't have to put on sort of a show for them anymore. And so it's comfortable and it's easy, and it's easy not to talk, and it's easy to just be quiet and all that kind of stuff. And the idea of like getting all revved up to talk and have this persona and say these things, I don't know. I just couldn't do it.
Well, I also think that there are some relationships, you know, I used to have friends who were, you know, married or, you know, been together a long time, and you would swear that the reason they were together was the aggravation, like that they thrived off the kind of aggravation that they gave each other. It was almost like a competition where, you know, one of them would do something and they got to complain about that for a bit, and then they got to have their revenge on that thing that they'd been aggrieved by. And there was this constant like seesaw. Like I remember when I was doing this TV show and Jem was in the States, she's shooting a bunch of commercials. So she was away for about 3 months. And the dude who was driving me around was like, oh, so your wife's, you know, traveling around America on her own. And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, don't you get like jealous or worried? And I'm like, no, dude. I'm like, I know how hard it was to get her to like me. If some dude reckons he can go up to her in a bar, drop some cheesy line, you know, and get her into bed, well, good luck to him, you know. I mean, what's your secret? Because she's not an idiot. You know what I mean? Like it's this weird kind of this jealousy. Like I don't necessarily get jealous because I sort of entrust that the people I've been attracted to in my life have had more intelligence than that, you know, or if they are going to cheat on you, then there's nothing you can do about it. So why would I waste my time? I would just hope that I'm a better judge of character. Look, this is coming from a guy who's never really been cheated on, so I've never had been completely blindsided, but I also think there is an element of, well, A, there's nothing you can do about it if it happens anyway, and B, you know, like, I feel like with Jem, like there is the thing that I liked most about her was she set a high standard. You know what I mean? She wasn't like easily swayed by some dickhead like me.
Well, here's the thing. I'm at the point now where if that did happen, I would just say, well, fuck, congratulations. Was it good?
Yeah.
Was it worth it? Did you have a good time? You know, yeah. I'm all right. You know, we've been together forever. So if you need something else, you know, what am I going to, there's nothing I can do other than just be myself, yeah. You know?
Well, it's just a weird power play. And I had an ex-girlfriend years ago who I think she had been cheated on with her ex like numerous times. And so she was constantly like looking for signs that I was doing the same thing. Like I remember once she came over to my apartment and I was making my bed and she was looking at the imprints in the mattress and she was like, there was someone else in this bed last night. And I'm like, no, there wasn't. And she's like, I can see there's two indentations on either side. And I was like, yeah, because I fell asleep on one side and then I rolled over onto the other side.
It's right.
It's not two bodies. But then what I came to realize was in a way, you know, like kind of a lot of unhealthy relationships, she would associate that with, this is love. You know, when you are in love, this is what happens, is there's this constant sort of like, you know, struggle and back and forth. And she associated that with, this is what a relationship is. There is constant suspicion and you know, guilt and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, people confuse that for chemistry or they confuse it for passion.
Yeah.
And it's really not supposed to be that way. It really is supposed to be almost just a really good relationship is really dull to talk about.
It's true.
It's really fucking boring to talk about. There's nothing to say.
Yeah, you know? It really is true. How do you go when it comes to do you guys agree to watch shows together? Or is it like you've got your programs, she's got her programs? Like that's something that Jem and I, we struggle with because we have limited time that we can watch things together. So we have certain, let's just watch shows we both like, which means there's a whole bunch of stuff that we like independently that we don't get to watch.
Well, here's what's going to happen now that you've started a family.
Yeah.
That's going to be a factor.
Okay.
In what you watch. And then you're going to watch things that all three of you can watch. Mm. And then you're going to find then that little person's going to grow up and have their opinions, and then they're going to pick shows. And so then you're going to watch shows that they want to watch or things that are appropriate for them. Mm. And then maybe you start your own TV relationship by yourself.
Right.
I have shows I watch by myself. I've got a ton of them.
Yeah, okay.
And then Amir and I will come together on a couple things, but then there's stuff that she only watches with my daughters that I'm not going to watch Grey's Anatomy.
Mm.
You know, I'm just not interested.
Yeah.
You know, so there's stuff that I let them all watch together, you know, but I do spend a lot of time watching TV by myself.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess it's more, because the TV is so dominant in our downstairs area, I will confine my viewings to my iPad like it's a dirty secret. You know what I mean? It's like I won't put the show on the big TV because that's the communal viewing experience, but I will definitely watch something on my mini iPad.
Yes, I have shows that I watch that I don't want them to show up in the queue.
Oh, of course.
I don't want her to know how many episodes of Love Island I've watched. Like, I don't want her to know how much, and The Bachelor. I've just discovered Love Island Australia. Right. So,
I've never seen a Love Island, but look, I mean, I can take a punt at the premise. So it's a bunch of sexy people get put on an island. And is there a competition element to it? Like, is it like there's only two winners at the end, or?
You have to end up in a couple.
Okay, right. That's the couple.
And then they start to eliminate people if they haven't coupled up. And then they keep adding new people. And then at the end, the couple that Australia likes the most, they vote for and they give them $50,000.
Oh, okay.
And they're the prettiest, dumbest people that have ever lived. They're some of the most wildly attractive, yet they've never had to work for anything. So I don't like to be mean, but books read amongst the whole crew, just not many.
Yeah.
Just not a lot. There's just not a lot of book reading going on.
But why would you? Like, that's the thing about beautiful people is that, because I often think about this. I have heard, as an actor, I've worked with a lot of really beautiful people, and you hear the other side of it. It's like, well, I never get taken seriously, you know, because of my looks. People assume that I'm dumb or whatever. And I'm like, yeah, but the upside of being beautiful is you get given everything. Like, you see the way, when you are struck by like real genuine beauty, like there's certain people, there's certain performers, musicians or actors or models or whatever that you're like, you were never going to be working behind, you know, a coffee machine or something like that. You're too beautiful. Like, the world is not set up like that. We like to celebrate beauty. And to
see, we do.
And to see the way, like, people kind of, like, there was this girl that I worked with on a TV show that, you know, she is just so beautiful that I was telling Gemma about her. I was at a rehearsal once and she did that Charlie's Angel thing where she let out, like, her hair and fluffed it. And I've never seen hair just go poof, like it popped out perfectly. It was the most incredible thing. And so I was telling Gemma about this girl, and Gem's like, oh, well, come on, you know, like, how beautiful can she be? And then we were at a function and Gemma saw her and involuntarily kissed her on the cheek, which is introduced herself and kissed her. And then was like, I couldn't help it. Like, she was so beautiful.
Yeah.
Her skin was so perfect.
Yeah. You even find that they know they're attractive. That's the other thing. They all know they're attractive.
Yeah.
And they say to each other, what's really interesting is that the men are really familiar with each other. There's a lot of hugging with the men.
Right.
And a lot of, like, it's sort of like lions. They're like a bunch of lions rubbing off on each other.
Mm.
It's fascinating. It's fascinating television.
Well Gem and I always sort of like classify people. Like, so you've got your regular good-looking people, which I think is like a domestic pet. So, you know, your mate might have a German Shepherd. It's a good-looking dog. German Shepherd's a good-looking dog.
Sure.
But then there's racehorses. There's certain people that are just like, they are, look at this thing. It is magnificent.
Yeah. It's tall. It's magnificent.
It's lean. It's like every genetic advantage in the world has been poured into this thing. And I remember I was telling another friend of mine about this theory about racehorses. You know, I said, look, you know, you're a good looking person. But then there are racehorses. And she was so offended that I didn't classify her as a racehorse. And I said, but you have to think about the animal kingdom. Like, look at every, like 90% of animals, and then look at a racehorse. Like, they are perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. 100%. Yeah. It's like cars. You know, they're just like, there's just some cars you just go, that's a supercar. That's just what that is. I did find the one thing I do find about my relationship is that we suddenly will, we do have a few television areas where we are together, or we'll discover something together. Like, we discovered F1 racing.
Wow.
Yeah, there's the Netflix series about it, and we watched it, and then we found ourselves putting the races on the weekends. And now I'm kind of down with it.
Have you always been a car guy?
Never.
Right.
I mean, I have had cars, and I had a muscle car in high school, and I like cars, but I don't know a ton about them.
Right.
But I was never into racing.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
because in America, it's all NASCAR.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, Formula One is very much that kind of blue chip, high society kind of.
Oh my God! It's like tennis.
Yes. Yes.
All the drivers are small and good looking.
Mm.
And it's dangerous, and it's amazing. Lewis Hamilton is. He's Lewis Hamilton, and he's the greatest.
Yeah, it's a strange thing, isn't it? Too that like it's essentially as a sport, it's about let's strap these tiny little men to rockets and fly them around a track.
Yeah,
you know, at 200 miles an hour.
Yeah. Have you been to the race? Have you gone to the race?
Yeah. So in Victoria they have a Formula One race at Albert Park. They'd actually just lost it this year because of COVID, because they couldn't guarantee everyone would have to have quarantined for 2 weeks, and so they're not going to have it this year. But it's meant to be in November. I went once, and it was exciting, but I could not like you know when those cars go past, you see them for about a second and then they're gone.
Yeah.
It's a bit like horse racing in the sense that it's really more about the party. It's about being in those groups. It is such an elitist kind of sport, and the people there are elitist, and it's a very corporatized event as well. So you have marquees for all these, you know, Tag Heuer and, you know, Heineken and, you know, all these big international conglomerates have tents there. I mean, my brother is way into car racing and into cars, but I just sort of don't. I'm very basic when it comes to my sports appreciation. Like, it's funny, I used to love sport as a kid, all different kinds of sport. And then, like a lot of things, as I've gotten older, I've just focused in on the one that I feel like I have enough attention for, which is like Aussie rules. You know, I used to love cricket and basketball and, you know, the Olympics I get into every year. But now I'm just like, oh, man, I don't have enough energy. Like, I think if I'm going to sort of dedicate my time to watching something, it can't be a sport that runs all year round for a start, because, you know, I need to have some time off.
Yeah.
But also I think the real thing that ties you into sport is the narrative, you know, like you need to sort of know the storylines of, say, you know, a racer's background, or, you know, how many Grand Prix has he won? You know, is he on the way back from something, blah, blah, blah. But it takes effort to invest in all those storylines. And I find, like, you know, with the NBA, like as soon as I took a year or two off that, I just didn't know who anyone was. When I tried to start watching it again, I'm like, oh, I've got to learn who all these players are again. I mean, you've got these sort of guys who've been around forever, but it's a lot of effort to invest in those storylines. And now we live in a time too where, you know, there is 24/7 coverage on any sport that you want. Like every team will have its own digital department that's putting out, you know, behind the scenes videos or marketing material all the time. It's a lot to take in.
Yeah, totally. The thing that was so great, I think if everything had its own Netflix series, it would make a difference.
Yes.
Because the Netflix thing just sort of coalesced all of it for you. You got to know who the team owners were. You got to know who all the drivers were. You got to know what their stories were a little bit. You got a little history, a little drama. So you're suddenly in, you know, a couple of the names. So, and then, you know, people die. Like, it's fucking, you know, the stakes are super high.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, and the crashes are incredible. And, you know, it's just, I don't know. It's just a weird thing.
What do you think, like, it's got to be like an adrenaline addiction, right? The idea that you get into a sport like that, which is so dangerous and so intense, like what your body is going through in terms of, you know, being in that car, you know, traveling at those speeds and the concentration and, you know, they get all kinds of like nerve damage from holding the wheel and the vibrations and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But do you think that in the same way that if you're a rock star who plays, you know, Wembley, it's very hard for you to then come back to your suburban home and live a normal life because you've experienced life through these eyes. Do you think it's the same for like a Formula One driver? Like, how do you adjust for normal life when you're used to traveling through life at 200 miles an hour? You know what I mean?
I don't know. They don't last that long. You know, they, like tennis players, they peter out in their 30s.
Yeah.
You know, they get, and why, who knows why, it's still driving. Why would you not be as good at 21 as you are at 34 unless there's just more mortality to deal with?
I think so. I mean, as you get older, you probably would be like, you know what it's like in your 20s, you're invincible and, you know, anything can happen and you're cocky and then you have something to lose. And also if you've built a legacy, like you've actually won, you know, some Grand Prix, you know, family aside, like you've got more to lose now, not only like through like having an accident or something, but if you drop off the pace, you don't get better. I heard in Quentin Tarantino did Rogan's podcast the other day and he was talking about, you know, he's always said he's going to make 10 films and that'll be it. You know, he's since like his second or third film, he's had this idea that he'll make 10 films and then he's out. That's it. He'll be done. And he was sort of...
How many has he made?
9. So he's got one more to go.
Oh, wow.
So he was saying that, you know, he feels... Because Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was such a big hit and won awards and was really well reviewed. He was saying he feels like the pressure's off. It's not like he has to finish with a big bang. He feels like... He's delivered, you know, that kind of penultimate piece of art.
Yeah.
And now the last film he's going to make is just going to be, you know, his farewell. But when Joe was sort of pressing him to say, but you're in such a good space, you know, like obviously you'll still have something to say creatively. But he was saying, but, you know, I'm a cinephile. You know, I study film, I study directors. He's gone, no director gets better the longer they go on. You know, it's just the nature of art. You know, you get to a certain point, you create a certain thing, and then for whatever reason, you know, maybe you run out of ideas or the fire in the belly gets a bit less or whatever it is, you just don't keep making outstanding work. And so
Is that true? Do you think that's true?
Well,
do you think that's true?
I don't know.
Who? I mean, Clint Eastwood made some pretty – I mean, I don't love Clint Eastwood as a
person.
Whole thing.
Yeah.
But he has made some pretty good movies in his later years.
Yeah, I think – Yeah, but you would say it's spotty. Like he's made some good films, but he's made some average films. And I think
nothing is as good as Unforgiven, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but you know, if you look at music, like look at Bowie. Like Bowie stayed relevant right till the end. But you wouldn't say that his last 10 years of, you know, releasing albums were as impactful as his first 20. You know, so I think that's what he's saying is he just wants to leave the audience wanting more. Which, you know, to go back to the F1 thing, I can sort of understand that. It's like, well, you know, I racked up all these awards and I was doing this. And then what am I going to be? Like the guy who his career kind of peters out. Like it's hard to know when the party's over.
I guess. No, because I think about it with stand-up all the time.
Yeah, right.
You know, I'm 58. So there are days where I go, I think my best stand-up album is behind me.
Yeah.
And I like some of this stuff that I'm doing, but I don't also feel the drive. I don't have the drive anymore.
Yeah.
I don't have the competitive nature of it.
Yeah.
I watch other people and I'm sort of amazed and kind of tired when I think about competing with them.
I'm the same. Like what do you think that is? Like I was thinking about acting the other day and it's like, you know, I enjoy it and I've had a, you know, pretty good career, but it's like the thought of having to do it again, you know, I'm just like, it's sometimes like you feel like your career restarts, like you have a good run of work and then it stops and then you're like, okay, well, you know, where's the next job coming from? And I'm like, well, maybe I just want to pivot to something else, you know, maybe I just pivot to something else and I just put my energy into that because, you know, I've always sort of felt like I didn't really know what my strengths were as a creative person. You know, I like to write, I like to act, I like to produce. There's all these things that I like to do. And I never really like 100% focused on any one thing. In my mind, it's always, I just want to communicate. I just want to tell stories. I just want to get out there. You know, that's what podcasting was essentially. It was like, okay, well, you know, I've got this friend and we like to talk bullshit. And so let's just see if there's an audience there for it. And I'm at that sort of point where it's like, I'm like you, I don't feel that, like I have a lot of friends who are actors who are younger, they're in that, they're sort of late 20s, early 30s, and I see that kind of drive, and you're right, it is a almost competitive edge, you know, where they're aware of what their contemporaries are doing, and they're, you know, they want to get this job, and they get pissed off when they don't get this, and whereas I don't have any of that anymore, like I, you know, I don't really worry about what other people are doing or really keep tabs on other people's careers anymore. I'm just sort of more focused. Well, it's more that I'm thinking about like, all right, well, what I think becoming a dad has sort of changed a little bit of that because I just want to know what can I do now that will keep me around at home more or, you know, have my, have it less of a gypsy kind of like lifestyle, because, you know, we used to travel so much, Gemini. It was like a traveling circus. And one kid is easy to travel with, but as she gets older, you know, we're going to need to set down some roots and, you know, put her into a school and all that kind of stuff. So I'm starting to think now about, well, what can I do that keeps me in one place?
Right. Yeah, no, actually, I mean, but then you never know. It's like all of a sudden a script could come across your desk and you could be like, oh my God, this part is perfect. This is the kind of part I've always wanted to play.
Yeah.
You know, this is something I could do for a while, or, you know, who knows?
Well, I think those things that you can't get out of your head, of course, but I think it's more the bread and butter jobs, more the kind of things where you're like, okay, well, I just need to do this because I've got to pay rent or whatever. And
yeah,
it's that sort of stuff that you give less of a shit about. You know what I mean? Like, it's almost like you either choosing something because the work is so outstanding, you just have to be involved. And I've always said that. Like, I've got a lot of friends who are directors or you know, they have a script and they're nervous about sending it to an actor because they think, well, they probably won't consider it because we don't have a lot of money or it's for scale or whatever. And I'm firmly the belief that I'd say 90% of actors will do something if the script is good, because it's so rare to get a really good script. And if you have someone come in and say, hey, look, I'd love you to do this. We don't have a lot of money, but, you know, let's collaborate on this. That's all you want. I mean, actors are very low on the creative totem when it comes to making stuff, because essentially you're saying lines that someone else has written, you're wearing clothes that someone else has designed, and you're being told how to do everything by a director. So
when
someone comes along and invites you into the process and, you know, they've written something for you, like that's an attractive thing. But it's more the other stuff, you know. It's getting, I guess the philosophy would be, I'm just not sweating the small stuff anymore, you know.
Like
the things that are out of your control, or the things that, you know, you don't really give a shit about anyway. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I'm also really aware that I had my time, my opportunities, my successes. Like there was a period where I worked all the time and I was constantly being thought of for projects, and things would come to my agent and stuff sort of moved like that, you know, but then eventually it just sort of quiets down a little bit, you know, and you're watching other people's Netflix specials and sometimes you can tell, you're like, wow, that guy really has the zeitgeist. He's really in the zeitgeist. He really is in the moment. And I'm not right there anymore. Yeah. You know, I'm not. So it's interesting. Did you see Bo Burnham's special?
No, I haven't seen it yet.
Have you heard about it?
Yeah. I was talking with Will about it the other day.
It's just a mind blower. It's one of those things where you go, fuck, I'm the laziest person that ever lived. This guy took every moment that he had during the pandemic and made this one man show in his studio. And it is fucking unreal. It's so good, man. And you really impressive.
That's inspiring though, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was sort of like, or seeing, you know, a couple of years ago when Hannah Gadsby's special came to the, you know, when it hit Netflix, and all of a sudden I was like, wow, holy shit, she really knocked it out of the park.
Yeah. You know? I mean, I think that for me, I was someone who was always hyper aware of what was going on around me. You know, I think it's that comparative trap where I would, you know, no matter what success I had, I would look to other people who had more success and be like, well, why aren't I on that lily pad? You know, like that person seems to be doing better. This is all well and good. And I remember I was getting therapy at the time, and it started off as like grief therapy after my mother passed away, but then it sort of got more about me. And I was sort of saying to my therapist, like I said, I just don't really feel like I've achieved anything, you know. And I said, because there's always people who have more than me, you know, and I feel like I'm constantly chasing that. And she said, well, you've set yourself up for failure perfectly, because you have your this idea in your head of what success looks like, and success always looks like something that you don't have. It's just a real simple perspective.
Totally.
I was like, yeah, that's right, because I'm always framing success under someone else's terms when – you know, if I look at what I've done, you know, I've had a pretty good run, and I'm not only just like career-wise, but in life. You know, I know plenty of people who have a lot of career success whose personal lives are a mess. But I feel really, really fortunate that, you know, I've got a really stable like marriage and family now, and you know, my friends and my family are all, you know, healthy and well. And it's like there's a lot of stuff to be grateful for. But you know, I think it stems back to when I was a kid. You know, going through, you know, I lost my father when I was quite young, and you know, my family went through all this kind of upheaval where we lost money and you know, all this kind of stuff. And so I had imprinted on my brain at a very early age this idea that shit goes wrong, that you know, you can never get too comfortable, you can never enjoy success because something will come to pull the rug out from under your feet. Because right. I have friends who are the opposite, you know, have had blessed lives, you know, where everything's worked out. You know, they've come from privilege and, you know, they've dabbled in something and it's been a huge success. And it really is true that like that begets further success, because if you feel like you can't fail, if you feel like that everything you touch turns to gold, then why wouldn't you move forward fearlessly into a new venture or trying new things? Because life has only taught you that these things go well for you.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I've been incredibly fortunate in my life and very lucky and had, you know, all kinds of success and but also I could compare it to somebody else's and say, but not as good as this person, yeah. or not as good as that person. Like it's really relative. Recently I've been, coaching, I coach comics a right. lot and I'm helping one comic work on a special, and I'm just fucking loving it. I love working on other people's shit. Yeah. I love looking at somebody else's act and helping them figure it out. I love going through jokes. I love being able to like help them sort of tell a story or, you know, do something and it not be me.
Yeah.
I'm really interested in, I'm less concerned about how I'm seen in the world as opposed to what I can do in the world.
It's easier to do that though, isn't it? Like I often have people send me stuff to read as well, and I really enjoy it because you don't have the hang-ups of what you're trying to say. You can be really objective and really positive as well. Like I think it's a good exercise in positivity because you want to obviously, you know, be constructive, but I think the best way to do that is to let someone know what's working first of all. You know, I like this, mm-hmm. I like that, you know, this is where I feel like maybe I wasn't sure what you were going for. Have you thought of this? Have you thought of that? But exactly. I agree, man. Like that's the best stuff.
Exactly. And that's the easiest thing to do. And most people take their own shit too seriously. And so you're able to sit back and go, look, this is just stand up. That's all it is.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to try and recreate the whole thing. You know, we're not going to try and reimagine the whole genre. We're just going to do some stand up. Or some writing. I've helped authors too.
And so what do you help people with like idea generation, like how someone can get they've got a bit they're working on, do you have a process for expanding on that or workshopping that?
Yeah. I mean, I just sort of like, I'll take my own notes on it and say, look, here's some areas where I think you could go with this. Here's where it looks like you were going to go, but didn't. And I expected you to. Here's where it's losing me. Here's where I'm not getting it, you know, just sort of like being able to go through it like that. And then also saying, you know, this is very similar to a thing that you were doing earlier and these two things could go together.
And in a lot of ways, like comedy is mathematical, isn't it? Like there is definitely like a formula and a structure to things. And it seems almost counterintuitive to be so analytical about something that makes people laugh, you know, because laughter feels like such a spontaneous primal response, but of course the way you get to that, you know, is structured.
Yeah, and some people like go on stage with a handful of notes, and other people have to write out every single word in their notebook before they say it, and then they say it exactly as they wrote it.
Yeah.
Like I don't know what Will does. Like, does Will write his jokes down? Does he just make notes? Does he write it all out? Does he perform it before he goes on stage?
I'm not sure. I think it's a combination of both. Like he definitely writes a lot, like, you know, copious amounts of notes. I'm not sure whether he writes out word for word what he's going to say. I think he writes the notes out and then he will workshop it on stage. He'll try and find it on stage. I mean, Will's one of the hardest working, you know, not just comedians, but people I know. Like even when, you know, 20 years ago when we first sort of met, like no matter what kind of night we'd had the night before, he was up first thing Sunday morning, you know, stacking newspapers into his office or just go to the desk and just start going through the papers and, you know, writing down notes, analyzing. And I've got a few friends like that who are comedians where it's a real blue collar work ethic when it comes to the base level, you know, just the baseline of comedy. They just sit down. They don't wait for inspiration. They just sit down and they just plug it out.
Wow, that is not me at all.
Right. You need inspiration?
I make a few notes. Something has to happen. I have to have an event happen in my life. Then I come home and make a few notes about it, you know, and then I try it out on stage.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't go looking for it.
And so,
and I probably should. I mean, I don't know that my way is right, but that's the way I've always written.
Well, when I am writing, I always find that, like, I'm redrafting a script at the moment, and the first 2 hours is agony. Like, it's just agony, you know, especially my brain's not working. I hate everything that's coming out. It all feels so artificial and fake, but you have to stick through that first 2 hours to then get to the flow state. Cause when you get to the flow state, it all comes. But every time I sit down for that first 2 hours is always like, you know, the moment of reckoning where I'm like, I try now not to read what I've written the day before. I try and just get to the end of what I'm doing and then go back to page one and go through again. But it's the process. Like, it is like, you know, painting a house. Like, for me, I have to just sort of get that first coat down. Even if I'm going to rewrite 90% of it, I have to get that down just to know that it's out, and then keep going and going and going and going until I find where I need to go. It's an unavoidable part of the process for me, is just to sort of have to sit and write garbage for 2 hours before I get to where I want to go.
Yeah. I mean, I think most people have trouble getting through that spot, you know, and it's the same for every writer. I started taking classes again because I wanted to be in class. I wanted to learn. And I also wanted to be able to read my work to people. I need feedback.
Yeah.
I need, you know what I mean? And I also need to, because there was no stand up, there was no performing. I needed to read it to a Zoom full of people.
Yeah.
You know, my writing.
And so this was a Zoom class?
Yeah.
How many people?
It was just a writing class.
How many people on the Zoom call?
30.
Right. Were you worried that anyone was doing a Jeffrey Toobin on the call while you're going through your writing?
What is that? What's it, Jeffrey Toobin?
Jeffrey Toobin is the CNN guy who is jerking off on the Zoom call.
Oh, no. I think about that guy. I think about, what the fuck were you, like?
Oh, man.
What were you thinking? What were you, I don't get it.
The question is, like, what part of it was getting him off? Was it the idea that he was getting away with something, or was it the idea that maybe someone was going to say, I mean, it is such an indictment on men, isn't it? Like, this dude could not wait for a half hour work call.
Couldn't wait.
Like,
and it wasn't like he was just some random writer. He was like a really
senior, like a senior journalist.
Yeah, senior writer. Yeah.
I mean,
if
it was a 14-year-old boy, I mean, I think maybe you'd be like, okay, look, he's 14, charged with hormones. Like, you can't, sometimes you just can't control yourself. But this is a grown man who should know better.
Yeah.
But then
just threw the whole thing away. Like, what does his wife and kids think?
The most staggering thing, though, is he got rehired. I couldn't believe it. If you want to watch the most cringeworthy television, check out his first appearance on CNN after that incident, where they literally go through what happened. And it's like, why hire him again? Like, I can't think of any other work situation I've ever been in with that. I mean, I know people have been fired for much less and certainly not invited back to talk about the thing that got them fired. It's fucking crazy.
Yeah. What was his excuse? What did he say? I just didn't realize what I was doing.
Well, no, I think he said it was a mistake, and, you know, he just a lapse of kind of judgment. It's like, that's not a lapse of judgment. Like, because to go through the process of doing that, there are many opportunities in which you can abort, you know, masturbation. Like, it's not like a split second decision to take a hit of a crack pipe or something like that. Like,
no,
there is
a process.
There are many off ramps.
Totally. Yeah, there are many off-ramps.
But I also just would love to be the, because I think the idea was he thought his camera was off. So clearly there were people still on the call. But imagine being the first person to clock like Jeffrey's window and be like, I think he's jerking off. Like, and then
holy shit.
What do you do? Like, do you immediately message, like private message the other people in the group and say, just look to the bottom left window? Jeffrey's either cleaning some glasses in his lap, or I think he's
Oh, fuck. Or do you just say to you, like, the other day I was in class and I was writing at the same time as I was in class and I was unmuted, and eventually someone in the class goes, Greg, stop typing.
All right.
And I was like, oh, fuck. Okay. I'm sorry. And I was just thinking that's where he was, but he was much further down the road.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you ever had a housemate that you've caught jerking off, but it is one of the most uncomfortable experiences that you can ever go through when you get home early from work and your housemate, you hear the TV snap off or the computer laptop shut, and you walk in and they're sitting there in their towel, sweating, and you're just like,
all red.
Yeah, yeah. I had a housemate who did that once, and then the worst part was he tried to overcompensate for what he'd been doing. I didn't mention anything, but it was clear what had been going on. But he decided to overcompensate by just acting cool, like standing up and walking around just wearing his bath towel. I'm like, dude, you still have a massive erection. This is not cool.
No, not cool at all.
Now, Greg, I don't know if you know this, but next year will be the 10-year anniversary of the death of Superpod.
Oh, my God.
Can you believe it's been 10 years since that seminal moment in podcasting?
No, that was such a big moment. 10 years. Holy shit. We should get the band back together.
I was thinking that. I mean, I did a little Instagram live with Dave last year, and we had a lot of people wanting us to reminisce. So I thought it'd be worth for the FOFOP audience maybe talking about that night, because it was great. Like, that was the first time we'd ever really met each other for the first time, like walking the room and TOFOP had got together.
Yeah.
And I had never really been on stage in front of like a comedy audience before. And it was like, I feel like Will and I have talked about it quite a bit, but it was such a magical show. Like, it just felt
like. Totally. Totally. I've had, like, it's one of the moments that have, as I look at my whole career, when I think of like events or shows where it just felt like we were rock stars.
Yeah.
Like, it was so, everyone was so up for it. You know, the crowd was so great. It was that pioneer days of podcasting where it was so special to everybody and it was so unique to have a podcast.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the festival was sort of like, wait, what is this? We got to move it to another room.
Yeah. Well, that's right. Because remember, we were booked into like just like a 50-seater, and then we kept getting bumped up to bigger and bigger rooms. And it was this sort of lightning in a bottle kind of thing where you guys took a massive gamble coming out to Australia. Like, you obviously had an audience here and stuff, but you didn't really know what that was going to translate into. You didn't really know, you know, what you're coming out for. And then to have that like lightning in a bottle kind of moment where it was like, like it was all these things sort of came together in this sort of once-off experience where, like it was just, what is a live podcast for a start? You know, is it stand-up? Is it not? And so to have that all come together and then, you know, the high-fiving afterwards and the bro hugs and feeling so, and feeling so good about it. And then the beautiful letdown the next night of Will all ashen-faced coming out to dinner and saying to us that they'd lost it. So do you remember whose idea it was to get Dave on, to tell Dave live on the podcast that we'd lost it?
I think it was, I feel like you and I were together and we decided to do that.
Yeah. Like, there was the initial
shock
of not having it. And then the idea, because Dave was doing, I think he was doing like solo stand up. So,
yes.
Yeah. So, okay. So maybe it was a joint decision to say, let's tell Dave live on air. Now, Will and I didn't know Dave that well at that time. Like, since then, obviously his personality is well established, but you with inside knowledge. So did you anticipate how it would go? Like, what were you thinking would happen when Dave was going to find out live on air?
Well, one of my favorite things about Dave is that he loses his mind. you know, shit really affects Dave in ways it doesn't quite affect other people. Like he really takes, Dave takes a lot of the world very personally.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I knew he would take it. I knew he would freak out.
So,
you know, but I also knew he'd end up being a good sport about it.
Yeah. 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 No, it was, I think there was a hint of that kind of, reality television element where we wanted the big moment, but we also needed to make sure that it wasn't going to get us pulled off the air. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, totally. And the thing about it was, is that the show was so good. The idea that it would not be shared was just kind of like, what?
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that at one point somebody had recorded off their phone of the show.
I think the entire thing is online as a bootleg. Someone recorded, which is incredible because, like you said, this was in the early days when we'd only been around for less than a year. And I think, I don't know how long Walking the Room had been going prior to that, but it wasn't like we had a huge audience or anything at that stage. Going back to Will's hotel room and starting the show, I was the most excited I've ever been about doing a podcast because you were texting with Dave the whole time and not telling him what was going on, just saying, hey, you need to come around to Will's hotel room. We're doing this podcast. And I remember too that, like, when I was talking to Dave about it, because we still think there's some shenanigans that were going on from the Melbourne Comedy Festival, because the story about how the podcast was lost seems inconsistent, because I believe at first they said they didn't record it, and then they changed that to it was a corrupted, memory card.
Yeah, right.
Which we were never given, so we didn't have a chance to kind of, because normally, you know, at a stand-up show they will record like multiple backups. You'll have, you know, going through the mixing desk, and then there'll also be like a second recorder. So it's really unusual that you'll have absolutely zero backup.
Yeah.
Dave and I, our best estimation is that they just didn't record it. Like whoever was the tech, because again, in their defense, it's a fucking what's a live podcast, who gives a shit? You know, this show was only announced four days ago.
No, they weren't on their best behavior.
No, like who
cares? They didn't know.
And so they didn't record it. But even, you know, if their story is legitimate and it was a corrupted memory card, then we need to find out. Like, I want to do a true crime podcast where we go through the steps that led to the death of Superpod. Like, where is that memory card? Who was the tech who was working that night? Like, let's
talk to the people that were there.
Yeah, let's put him under cross-examination and see if his story holds up.
Just admit it, guy. Just say you didn't record it. That's okay. It's over now.
Oh, shit, man. Can you imagine being interrogated by Dave Anthony? That'd be terrifying. That guy would break in 2 seconds.
Oh, my God. Oh, my. No, I know. I've seen Dave break people.
Yeah. Wouldn't even need to bust out the phone books. We'd have that guy cracked in 2 seconds.
Yeah, no. I had a stalker for a while, and Dave took care of that.
Really?
Yeah.
How?
Yeah. He did some research on her,
right,
and found out where she lived and where she worked.
So hang on, he stalked the stalker
and then confronted her.
Holy shit. Isn't that what they say not to do?
Yes.
Right.
And she went away.
Wow.
Yeah.
How many stalkers have you had in your career?
Just one. Maybe two. How about you?
Not stalkers so much, but it's funny you should say. I 4 days ago got the strangest private message through one of my social accounts, which happens from time to time. Where because I'm the youngest of a big family, so there are a bunch of, you know, cousins and family friends and stuff that I've never met who, you know, would be aware of me from stuff I've done, or, you know, they'll recognize a surname or whatever. I got this email out of the blue. I'd been talking to my brother about a week ago about this weird family that had lived next to our house in the like late 60s, early 70s, but way before I was born. And my brother had been sort of talking about this one neighbor in particular who he thinks was a bit, you know, fucked up. And I didn't really know who she was. And anyway, about a week later, I get this message in kind of, not broken English, but almost like someone who's uneducated, or, you know, just oddly, odd syntax and punctuation and stuff. And it was this woman saying, hi, you know, Charlie, I was a neighbor of yours, a long time ago. I loved your mother, and last night I felt her energy in the room with me, and she wanted me to contact you. And so, I reached out and blah, 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 blah. And so she wrote me this big long email, but it was all about being in contact with my dead mother, which is really odd. So I kind of didn't really think anything of it, because like I said, from time to time I'll get like a message from a distant contact or in a family member or something like that. I've got a little WhatsApp group with my brothers and sisters, so I just sort of posted that. And my brother called me privately and said, that's the fucking neighbor I was talking about. My brother has been trying to find this woman for about the last 3 or 4 months, because, he wanted to get in contact with her. And then out of the blue, because my dead mother appeared to her in a dream or something like that.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Yeah, she got in
contact. Holy shit.
Yeah, she got in contact. And so I haven't decided whether or not to get in contact with her. I had another one. I had this primary school teacher when I was in third grade. She was American, funnily enough. Her name was Sylvia Seymour. Stephanie Seymour was the model, right? Married to Axl Rose.
Yeah, right. Axl Rose.
Her name is Sylvia Seymour. And she was I went to a Catholic primary school, and she was insane, this woman, just a real kind of evangelical kind of Christian. And it was the mid-80s, and my older sister, Miranda, had given me a really cool undercut, shaved longer on the top and shaved underneath.
I think there was an
Aussie pop star at the time who had that haircut, and so my sister gave me the same haircut. And I remember I went to school, so what, third grade, you're 8 years old. I went to school, and as we're about to sort of go into assembly, she pulled me aside and said, you wait here. And then, waited for assembly to start, and then dragged me on stage and humiliated me in front of the entire school by making me do a 360 and saying, this haircut, this hippie haircut, is not acceptable at our school, and blah, blah, blah. And it was such a traumatizing experience for an 8-year-old.
Wow.
8 years old, you're sort of still, all your trust is in adults and stuff, and you do not expect to be humiliated in front of 300 of your classmates.
No.
And so I always was fuck this bitch. For the rest of my life was I'll never forgive. So she contacted me out of the blue. She must be in her late 80s now. And she was like, Charlie, it's, Sylvia Seymour. I'm so proud to see what you've become. And it took every fiber of my being not to say, lady, you could have made me, you could have set me on a path to become some fucking kind of heroin addict or something. That trauma you put me through as a kid over a fucking haircut. A fucking haircut.
Amazing. I had an old babysitter contact me.
Right.
Who was, or not a, not a, not a babysitter. She was a nanny, and she was Spanish, and she was, she used to hit me all the time.
Holy shit.
Yeah. She contacted me with the same, I can't believe what you've accomplished. It's so amazing.
I'm so glad I knocked some sense into you.
Yeah. I mean, I was just like, you used to push my fingernails back. You used to smack me in the face.
Oh my God.
Yeah. It was just so weird. I did have somebody contact me recently to let me know that they had named their daughter after my daughter.
Right.
That kind of name. My daughter's name is Mighty. Yes. And my youngest is named Mighty Luna, and they had decided to name their kid Mighty.
Yeah.
So I was pretty interesting.
Yeah. It's a bit I think at a distance, it's fine. I'm never sure whether to respond to those kind of bits of contact, because you just don't want it to get into a back and forth. And it's also this thing of, you have an association with me, which is much stronger from your end than it is from my end. For the same reason,
yes,
I haven't really gone to any of my high school reunions. I'm still friends with some guys from high school and stuff, but once I sort of left that world, I didn't really look back. I'm not one of those guys who I don't look back on high school as the greatest years of my life or anything. And it wasn't bad by any stretch. I had plenty of friends and had a great time, and it was a great experience, but it's not my thing. I'm not really nostalgic like that. And I also feel a little bit disadvantaged when I go into those kind of social situations, because, you know, because of the podcasts and stuff I've done on TV and stuff, people have an awareness of what I've been up to or where I've been in the last 20 years, where I don't. And I just, it's not a judgment thing, but I just feel awkward in those situations where people come to me with, you know, information about my own life or an awareness, you know, of stuff that I've discussed or, you know, things that they've read in the paper or whatever. And it's like, oh, this feels like an imbalanced interaction.
Yes, totally. Totally. Yeah, I went to my high school. I went to the first one, which was the 25th, I think. And I liked it, but I wouldn't do it again.
Yeah, right. I must admit.
I don't want to see everybody again.
I mean, I am curious. Like, I've got another mate who's a comedian, and, you know, he's sort of in the public eye, and he was going back, and, you know, he had a really good time. And I sort of looked at the Facebook. There's they had a group for that, you know, class of whatever, 95. And I checked out the photos, and I mean, for a start, did not recognize, I'd say, 80% of the people there. Like, too much time's passed now. And but I did feel a little pang of, oh, you know, maybe I'm at a stage now where I would like to go back and, you know, just connect with some of those guys and just find out what's going on. I think a lot of it early on was insecurity. You know, I just sort of felt like I needed to separate, like I needed to create a new identity for myself. I wanted to, you know, get away from who I was. And so, you know, keep moving forward and don't look back.
Yeah. But,
you know, sort of it relates a little bit to what we were discussing earlier about getting to a point in your life where you just don't sweat the small stuff anymore. And, you know, like, I think I, you know, maybe when the 30 year rolls around, maybe I'd be curious to go back because I don't give a shit as much anymore. Whereas I think in those early years, you know, I was just hyper aware of what people thought of me, or have I been successful enough to go back to a high school reunion? Like, am I going to spend the whole time apologizing for what my career is
or explaining
myself or whatever? Because, I mean, that's the other thing that sucks is when people, you know, say, what have you been up to lately? And it's like, well, I haven't been up to anything because my work is intermittent. Like, you know, it's not a full-time job. I don't always have a project, you know, or.
Yeah.
Have I seen you in something lately? No, not lately.
No, I had a guy actually say to me, I don't know what happened to you, but you weren't that funny in high school. And the irony of it is I was voted funniest in my high school, but that was what he said to me at the reunion. And I was just like, okay.
All right. Where I've moved to is like rural New South, well, not rural, they call it regional New South Wales. So, you know, it's kind of like a country town. And I was there with Jem and I went to the pub and I saw a guy that, you know, I was actually pretty good friends with in high school, like, you know, my final year of high school. I haven't seen him in 25 years and there he was. And so I just went over and said, how are you going? And we had a brief catch up and I said, like, what's been going on? He's like, well, tonight I've taken a tab of acid and I've just drunk two tequila shots. And I was like, I don't think this is the time for us to reminisce. Like, I just don't know that. I don't know where this is going to get us. But it was funny because he, you know, he wasn't quite up on the acid yet. He was still quite lucid. But when we were talking, he was like, oh, and I've been following, you know, you've been doing really well. I've been following all your stuff. And I could tell in that statement that he was aware that I, like, I work in entertainment, but he was not really aware of anything.
Yeah.
He was being polite.
Yeah.
Which is fine.
Yeah, it's totally fine.
Yeah.
Too bad you didn't get him an hour later.
I know. Part of me was tempted to go back. We exchanged numbers and stuff, and I was like, I wonder if that was a moment of he's going to wake up next morning and go, oh, fuck, I can't believe. Just had that moment of, like, blatant honesty with a guy I haven't seen in 25 years.
It's a ballsy move to go to a pub on acid.
Yeah.
Like, that's just too much people for me.
Yeah, I think where I live now is it's very much that, you know, it's kind of a hippie sort of town. So it's not highly unusual. Yeah. It's not really like it's a pretty relaxed atmosphere. So there is a lot of people, but it's not like you're packed indoors, like you're in a beer garden next to the ocean. You know, it's actually probably quite a nice place to take acid.
Oh, okay.
But I think from what I understand, from what the young people tell me, Greg, I think acid is on the way back. I think that that's what the young people are getting back into now is just
really?
Psychedelics seems to be on the rise again. Yeah. yeah, I think it's just bang for your buck and more affordable. So
right.
You know, that's what the young people are
They're looking to legalize it here.
Acid.
Psilocybin, mushrooms.
Yeah. I thought it was legal in Portland. Well, it's decriminalized at least, right?
Yeah, decriminalized, yeah.
From what I understand from the scientific studies they've done around psilocybin and therapy, especially for people with PTSD, it's fantastic.
Yeah, it's apparently great.
I know a lot of people who microdose I felt like there was a period of time where nearly every second person I spoke to was microdosing mushrooms, and all of them have said to me that it improved their mood, stabilized them, like tiny, tiny amounts, not so you're getting any psychotropic effects, but enough that you're just getting that lift in kind of, like an antidepressant, I guess, but it's kind of an antidepressant.
Yeah, that's interesting. I know a couple people that do it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't really understand, well, maybe I'm just a cynic, but it's like I understand the concept of microdosing, but who's portioning the doses, you know?
Yes, and how often are you taking them?
Yeah, because, look, I mean, my experience with drug dealers is they don't necessarily follow regulations.
No.
There's no, like, governing body, overarching body.
No. Are they getting it, but are they doing it through a psychiatrist?
No, I think it's all just, like, black markety type stuff.
Oh, wow, okay.
I mean, that's the insane thing is when you think about, I mean, it's like CBD oil, you know, that's there are so many people that you can get CBD oil from, you know, if you're treating cancer or, you know, that kind of stuff, that the fact that they just don't legalize it and regulate it, you know, just it makes so much sense.
Yeah, totally. They would make a ton of money.
Yeah. Well, that's what's happened in Colorado and stuff, right? Like when Colorado legalized weed, didn't it just like suddenly put all this money into the coffers?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I think that's a long way off. Australia, as much as we love to project this image of being this sort of larrikin country, we're at our core a very conservative country, very conservative values and attitudes especially when it comes to things like that.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Australia and America are very similar.
Right.
There is when I was touring there, I really did start to notice, like, you guys have an indigenous problem, and you have a problem with, there's racism and there's all kinds of, there's all kinds of very similar sort of states' rights and all that stuff.
I think it's a product of colonialism in general, Greg. I'd say that any country you go to where land is taken away from the original inhabitants and then certain policies are put in place where the new inhabitants sort of say people who look like us are cool, but everyone else can go get
right.
You're going to have some issues. Yeah, I think Australia, there's a lot of things I love about this country, but I do believe there is a disconnect with the image that we project, or what we believe our image is, or what our identity is, and then what is actually put into practice. I think there's a real disconnect. Australians love that idea of, you know, we're just knockabout kind of larrikins, but I think at our core we're rule followers and we're, quite conservative. Like, Australians love dobbing in each other to the cops. Like, there is no any anti-authority sentiment that happened with the convicts who came out here is long gone. We are very much a nation of cops. We love to be dibber-dobbers and pull people into line. If you've ever listened to an episode of TOEFOP, I'm the worst offender. I've yelled at teenagers for being too loud.
Yeah.
I've turned into that old man.
Yeah, me too.
Although there is a sense of satisfaction, like I was saying to Will, because Will's very much anti-authority and he's still got the fire burning, he's still rage against the machine. But I was saying to him, I had to embrace, you got to embrace certain cliches of being a middle-aged man. And, if I can't shout at teenagers now, when will I ever be able to shout at teenagers?
Exactly. Or to just be baffled by them.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got a 16 and a 19-year-old.
Right.
And they both make me feel like I used to really wish that I was young again, and now I don't. I look at them and I think, oh, it's so hard to be 20.
Yeah.
So hard to be 19.
I wouldn't want to go back to my 20s for anything. Like, for anything. I mean, there's really nothing about it that maybe if I could go back with the knowledge I have now, then maybe. But, you know, your 20s is just so full of finding out who you are, you know. And I think for a lot of us, the easiest way to create that identity is identifying what you hate, you know. I don't like this exactly. kind of music. I don't like these kind of movies. I don't like these kind of crowds. I don't like this kind of fashion. It's all negative, 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 because it's just the fastest way to create a personality. I fucking hate this. I fucking hate that. You'll sit around and you'll bitch people out. And then something happens, you know, you cross over 30 and people start coupling up and careers start stabilizing and just gets less competitive. And I don't know, you just start to chill out a bit. And now I'm in my 40s. I just feel it's probably the most I feel the healthiest I've ever been. Like, I'm eating better, I'm exercising better, everything is good. But it's just the mental health. And I think it's like the writing process. I think you have to go through that painful 20s and 30s to get to the point where you're like, okay, I'm in the flow state now, and you know, you don't let the bullshit. What's your podcast? You don't let fuckers.
You don't take bullshit from fuckers.
Don't take bullshit from fuckers.
Yeah, I just don't have time for it. I don't have the time. If you're unpleasant, you're out of my life. It's just really simple. I have no problem with blocking people.
Yeah, right.
I have no problem with, you know, just saying, okay, that energy, not for me. Right. I don't need to fight to make that work, you know. But I also love the fact that, like, no one's paying attention to me anymore, so I can do whatever I want. You know, if I want, you know, no one's paying attention. Nobody gives a shit.
Yeah.
So I can dress any way that I want. That's I can so read true. Whatever I want. I can think whatever I want. Nobody cares what bands I'm listening to, so it doesn't really matter.
I've never had that experience of being, like, invisible to a certain demographic of the population until about 2 weeks ago, where – so our local cafe, it's all staffed by these cool, hip young things, you know, just really cool, you know, late teens, early 20s hipsters. And I'm quite friendly with all of them because, you know, this is my regular hangout, my cafe. And Gemma and I were at the beach about 2 weeks ago, and one of the cool young waitresses that was there with her friend. And so we, you know, waved and said hello and stuff. And her friend was just like, I could sense, was like, why are you talking to those old people with a baby? Like, just couldn't understand why her friend, because they're cool and young and hot and, you know, we're these two daggy, like, middle-aged people. And then at one stage, she and a friend went in for a surf. And so there was Gemma and I sitting right next to them with our baby. And then there were those couple of young guys, like, almost, you know, 70 meters away. And this girl looked around, looked at us, and decided to go 70 meters to the young guys and say, hey, can you mind our stuff while we go for a surf? Because rather than, because it was almost like she's like, well, these guys won't understand what I'm talking about. You know, it's like we won't speak their language.
Right. I'm not even going to attempt it.
Yeah, and then Gemma was like, because I was like, Gemma, did you see that? And she's like, what? And I'm like, they refused to talk to us because we're old. Like, she didn't want to engage with us because we're a couple of olds. And she was like, you're being paranoid. I'm like, no, like, we're sitting right here. We have a relationship with one of them, but she just did not want to engage us. She'd rather talk to those two guys way over there because they're young and cool rather than, like, engage us.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Yeah, it's interesting. And, you know, my daughter is incredibly cool. They both are. But when she brings her friends over, I go upstairs. I just am like, I can't. It just makes me feel too lost.
Yeah. Yeah. And you don't also, like, you don't want to have your worldview shattered. Like, I'm trying to educate Iona. Like, we play her a lot of music now, and she really, at the moment, she's really into, like, 70s metal, like Iron Maiden, and, you know, she likes heavy rock, Led Zeppelin. She likes really melodic kind of rock. But I know there is going to come a point where she starts choosing her own music, and it's probably not going to gel with our tastes and just being giving over to that.
When True and Mighty were little, we used to listen to old 60s ska all the time.
Right.
All the time. And, like, 3 days ago, something came on the radio that was like that. And my daughter goes, oh, I hate this stuff. You know, like, she just sort of, like, turned on it, you know. And then I think there'll be a come a time later where she has a fondness for it again.
Yeah.
Because it reminds her, you know what I mean?
Well, you got to reject to then embrace, right? Like, you reject.
You got to reject.
You got to reject to then embrace. Yeah. Well, Greg, look, this has been fantastic. It's been too long. It's so good to see you. I'm so happy to have
you.
Same
here,
on the
man.
Show.
Yeah, it's so great to see you.
And I'd love to have you back on. And, you know, let's see where the world is again in 12 months. And maybe for the 10-year anniversary of Superpod, we can get the band back together. That'd be great.
It would be amazing. I think Dave and I would love to do that.
And would have to actually make sure that there's a couple of multiple digital recorders doing backup. Although, there is something amazing about doing a 10-year anniversary Superpod and losing that one as well.
Oh, my God, that'd be amazing. It'd be perfect. It would be so perfect.
But now we've said it out loud, we can't do it. We're going to have to think up another twist to make sure we can lose it in a way that feels like we haven't orchestrated it.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Do you want to?
Yeah, that'd be fun.
Do you want to promote anything before we go?
You can follow me on Instagram at It's Gregers, ItsGregers. And my podcast is on iTunes, Spotify, all those things. It's called Don't Take Bullshit from Fuckers.
Don't Take Bullshit from Fuckers. Greg Barrett, thanks so much.
Awesome, dude.